Communication message. I'm Vanessa Denha-Garmo, a communications evangelist.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio, 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit. The FCC requires us to reduce our power at sunset. For those affected by this change, we invite you to listen on the internet at AveMariaRadio.net.
And EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
A good Catholic is a faithful citizen.
Make America great again!
What's more important here is not saving the country, it's saving your soul.
It's a bold strategy. Let's see if it pays off.
Our trust in the media has hit its lowest point.
I want the truth!
What is truth?
The age of the passive layperson can't go on.
It's our job to share that love of Christ with these people.
This is an excellent mission, sir, with an extremely valuable objective.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
Al, this is an excellent program.
You have a wonderful show.
I love listening in my car.
That's a great question to start off with.
You are in for a show tonight.
Here we go again.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. We've got a great hour in front of us here. I want to look at, let me start over again here. Throughout most of Western history, it was believed that human existence, human life, in fact, all of life, was a result of divine creation. That's still the predominant idea in most people's mind. But beginning in the 19th century, there were people proposing the idea that explaining the natural world didn't require assuming the existence of a designer or a divine creator. That the incredible complexity of the universe, its apparent design, could be explained more satisfactorily by appealing to random naturalistic forces that, you know, got stirred into operation somehow, but they had no prevision of the end they were achieving. And that what we might think is designed is, in fact, just the product of these naturalistic forces. My guest, Douglas Axe, will tell us a little bit about his own history on this point, about his own upbringing, about his young conversion to Christianity, and then his entry into the scientific world and the scientific establishment, and his conviction that the world of the sciences, and in particular his field of biology, that this provides a wonderful basis to confirm the popular intuition that we are designed. In fact, there's among the many arguments for the existence of God, there's one which is in some ways not an argument, it's an observation, but it's sometimes called the argument from universal consent. And that is, if you look over the history of the human race and you look over people's writings, look over the art, you look over the makers of culture, you just do man-on-the-street interviews, and what you'll find is that most people have an intuition that life has purpose and meaning, that in some way there is some sort of God out there, some intelligent force that's at work. Now, people disagree about who that is, what that is, how it works. But there's a widespread intuition that our existence here is the result of something more than purposeless, random, naturalistic processes. And Douglas is going to talk to us about how, in his own work, he's been able to demonstrate or confirm that from his own experimentation and his own demonstrations. The key to understanding our origin, he claims, is this design intuition. And this is the innate belief that tasks requiring knowledge to accomplish, okay, can only be accomplished by someone who has that knowledge. And for the ingenious task of inventing life, the only one capable of fulfilling that task would be someone that we commonly would call God. So that's coming up in the next hour, Chris, in the afternoon. We are utterly beyond the reach of accident, he'll argue. But first, let's get to today's headlines with Nick Tom.
Thank you very much, Al. Welcome, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, January 19th. It is the Feast of St. Fabian, and today's news is brought to you in part by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. As Donald Trump prepares for his inaugural address, reports say his speech will last about 20 minutes. Lisa G. reports.
The longest inaugural speech was by William Henry Harrison, who spoke for nearly 2 hours without a coat, developed pneumonia, it was a bitterly cold and wet day, and died 1 month later after taking office in 1841. The shortest inaugural address was by George Washington in 1793, his second inauguration. He spoke just 135 words before repeating the oath of office. Warren Harding was the first president to deliver his inauguration through loudspeakers in 1921, and in 1949, Harry Truman's address was the first to be broadcast on TV. Lisa G., NBC News Radio, Washington.
The U.S. is bombing suspected ISIS camps in Libya. U.S. defense officials said two American B-2 stealth bombers carried out the attack last night, and it is believed that the camps were destroyed. The ISIS influence has grown in Libya since longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi was killed in 2011. The strikes were authorized by President Obama. A former fundraiser for the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests has filed a lawsuit against the group, charging that it, quote, callously disregards the real interests of victims, end quote, in order to raise money from the plaintiff's lawyers. Gretchen Hammond, who is director of development for SNAP from 2011 to 2013, says in her lawsuit that SNAP is a, quote, commercial operation premised on farming out abuse victims as clients for attorneys, end quote. Quote, she reports that more than 80% of SNAP's revenues come from lawyers in donations that she describes as kickbacks paid by attorneys for whom the group provides clients. In her lawsuit filed in an Illinois court, Hammond charges that she was fired from her position at SNAP after she raised questions about the group's exploitation of sex abuse victims. And the price of a postage stamp is going back up this weekend. Last April, the cost of the Forever stamps dropped from 49 cents to 47 cents. Now the cost of mailing that 1 ounce first class letter is going back up to 49 cents. The price hike kicks in on Sunday. And now your fascinating fact for the day. Shakespeare was an insomniac. Reporting for Ave Maria Radio News, I'm Nick Tom.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Jeff Maris wrote a column recently. Find the name of it right here. Yeah, Denunciation, Condemnation, and Dire Warnings. Can these be Christian? It's a good piece. It's a very good piece. And he also lists 21 examples of forceful speech, tough talk, from the New Testament. And believe me, that just scratches the surface. And this is an important point to make because, unfortunately, you hardly ever hear tough talk in Catholic circles. There's a fear of candor and frankness. And what makes this sad is because, look, St. Paul himself spoke the language of love, but he also spoke the language of challenge. So we have to, if we're going to practice a truly Catholic rhetoric rooted in Scripture and the teaching of the Church, we've got to figure out a way of being able to talk tough and do the work of exhortation, admonition, and challenge. Now, a lot of times when this comes up, people think, well, if we just get out and denounce the sins of the culture more, we're doing our job. No, no, you're not. You can, if you do that improperly, you end up sounding like an angry, strident hothead. Now, you've got to consider the audience that you're trying to reach. When you're speaking with fellow Christians or those who share a belief in God, who believe that God has given us divinely revealed moral commandments, it's a lot easier to talk tough. I mean, that's who Jesus is addressing in his forceful language in the Gospel of Matthew, for instance, where he says, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." Now, what he shares with his audience at that point is they all believe that God has revealed something, and that they're all responsible to live in accord with it. Or this statement of Jesus. "Woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary for temptations to come, but woe to the man by whom the temptations come. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to enter life maimed or lame than with two hands or two feet and to be thrown into eternal fire." Again, Jesus can speak with that kind of forcefulness and that kind of tough talk because those with whom he's addressing already share some of the basic moral code, and they actually do believe in judgment. But if you notice, St. Paul, in Acts chapter 17, and he's addressing the Athenian philosophers who are more studied in Greek thought rather than Hebrew thought, he takes a little bit different approach to them. So you can see right on the pages of the New Testament that how we speak has a lot to do with who we're trying to reach. So I would just make the point today that in our own community, Christians need exhortation and admonition. They need confrontation. They need the definition of and the denunciation of evil. Our parishes are dying, not because we demand too much of our fellow Catholics, but because we're unwilling to risk offense by putting into practice the one another commands of St. Paul. Yes, the nice ones like pray for one another, love one another, serve one another, bear one another's burdens, but also the tougher one another commands like admonish one another, correct one another, exhort one another. In the general culture, though, where we don't share as many assumptions, especially about the nature of the good life, the moral life, tough talk, if not properly aimed, can generate resistance to our message. Protestant fundamentalists learned this beginning in the 1920s for certain. American culture had shifted, and the rhetoric of the revivalists, like Billy Sunday, began to sound strident, began to sound like that of an angry ethnic subculture, rather than a mainstream communication. So our message always has to consider the presuppositions, the assumptions of our intended audience. Let me use a political example right now. If you look at the political left's hilarious reaction to the election of Donald Trump, you'll see what I'm talking about. Those who share Mr. Trump's assumptions about America's origin and destiny are able to hear his tough critique, and they can even contextualize it in spite of some reckless remarks that he's made and in spite of his personal moral failures in the past. But for others who don't share his assumptions about America's origin and destiny, and I'm thinking here of actual friends and relatives, his tough talk sounds to them like the threatening rantings of a political antichrist. And he's written off as easily as Protestant fundamentalists, or at least he was during the campaign. His language, his rhetoric may in fact change considerably as president. We'll see. But they can't imagine a country with so many people who voted for Mr. Trump. Now, this shock has actually opened up the door for better communication with them about matters more important than politics. You know, so for me, this is turning into a windfall. But listen, to give you an idea of how the tough talk can traumatize or alienate people, there's a an Episcopal parish in Pasadena. It's All Saints Church, where the rector there, Mike Kinman, told the congregation in a blog post that they were removing the proper names from their prayers for those in authority. They used to pray for Barack, our president. Now they're simply going to be praying for our president and all others in authority. They won't use the name Donald Trump because they say it might trigger microaggressions in the minds and hearts of some members of our congregation. Let me give you his quote here. We are in a unique situation in my lifetime where we have a president-elect whose name is literally a trauma trigger to some people, particularly women and people who, because of his words and actions, he represents an active danger to health and safety. Now, yes, to me this is complete. This is silly. I'm sorry. This represents a degree of sensitivity. It's actually a patronizing view of his own congregation. But how do you speak to a group like that? That's my point. Now, I like to also point out that, look, feminists, homosexual activists, Black Lives Matter, they don't moderate their message to a culture that's indifferent to their concerns. And some people say, well, look, they talk tough and get away with it. Yeah. You know why? Because at root, these activists and their audience actually do share certain secularist presuppositions about freedom and the rights of the individual and the role of government in coercing people's behavior. I mean, the reason feminists and homosexual activists and Black Lives Matter have been able to talk tough to this general culture is because they're exploiting the general culture's hypocrisy. This culture holds shared assumptions, and that assumption is it's okay to deny objective truth in order to expand personal freedoms. You see this with abortion. You deny the objective truth of the humanity of the unborn in order to expand freedoms for the woman with the unwanted pregnancy. So the reason feminists, homosexual activists, and Black Lives Matter can talk tough to this culture is because they share this assumption that objective truths can be sacrificed in order to expand personal freedoms and to get the federal government to coerce the general culture in order to exercise those freedoms.
Did you know that Ave Maria Town in Southwest Florida is really growing?
Tell me about it.
Ave Maria truly is one of the nation's fastest-growing master-planned new home communities.
Is that because there's no snow?
Well, the weather sure helps, but Ave Maria, Florida is a unique place.
How so?
The town of Ave Maria has been designed as a hometown for the 21st century, a place where residents of different generations and backgrounds can find all they need to live life to the fullest. School, shopping, employment opportunities, and more. In addition, the presence of Ave Maria University, a Catholic university that is both excellent and affordable.
Sounds great. What else?
Houses are being sold starting in the low 200s with several communities to choose from. There's a private Catholic K-12 school along with golf, bike trails, a fitness center, not to mention several daily masses and adoration within walking distance.
So how can I arrange a visit?
Call Carol at 239-249-2111. That's Carol Carpenter at Berkshire Hathaway, 239-249-2111.
Looking for affordable Catholic health care? Look no further. CMF Curo is the only Catholic health ministry which provides an established health care program, spiritual growth opportunities within Catholic community, and unique wellness programs and health tools. Plus, it is half the cost of many insurances. Learn more at mycatholichealthcare.com or visit cmfcuro.com. CMF Curo, it's my Catholic health care.
Are you looking for a school that is authentically Catholic? Are you looking for a school that understands that its primary mission is to provide every student with a life-changing encounter with Jesus? Then look no further than Our Lady of Good Counsel Parish School in Plymouth. We invite you to attend our winter open house Sunday, January 29th from 11:30 to 1:30. January 29th from 11:30 to 1:30. More information at imolgc.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is brought to you in part by the Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds offer equity and fixed income mutual funds that can combat today's low interest rates that harm many long-term investment plans. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Their portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. To learn more, the number is toll-free, 1-866-AVE-MARIA, or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is discipline kind? I feel like I'm nagging you because I've asked that question 5 times. And this is the 5th reason I'm going to give you why discipline is ultimately kind. Routinely, parents will walk into my office and say, "My child has a poor self-image." Why is that? At the basis of many, if not most, of these poor self-images is an undisciplined child. Undisciplined people smack up against the world. They smack up against other people. They create friction with other people. And they realize that other people do not like to be around them. Their peers, maybe a Sunday school teacher, other adults in the family. Even grandma can be pushed to her limit by this child. So what happens to a self-image? It gets battered. It gets bruised. It gets knocked around. Discipline is kind because it teaches a child you have to control your behavior around other people. And ultimately, your self-image will not go into tatters because other people are giving you messages, "We don't like you, son." Discipline is kind. It ultimately leads to a good self-image. I'm Dr. Ray.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. To what or to whom do we owe our existence? This has to be the starting point for people who take life seriously. You know, whether you're a scientist or a philosopher or a theologian, everybody asks the question, where did I come from? To what or to whom do we owe our existence? And it seems to me most people can't, once they grab on to that question, they have a hard time resting without coming up with some sort of answer. Because, logically speaking, so much else flows from that fundamental question of to whom do we owe our existence? And, of course, in today's day and age, that question always includes reflections upon the role of biology and also evolutionary thought. My guest, Douglas Axe, was interested in physical and engineering sciences than he was in biology until, as a graduate student, he began to see how life is an example of extraordinary engineering. And from that point on, he became intrigued by the possibility of using science to make the connection between design and biology clear. His pursuit of this science to make the connection more clear, but it also made clear the need to describe the results in terms that would make sense to everyone. And he's done that in his book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. Dr. Axe is the director of Biologic Institute, a nonprofit research organization launched by the Discovery Institute in Seattle. And he holds postdoctoral and research science. He's held postdoctoral and research science positions at the University of Cambridge, the Cambridge Medical Research Council Center. And his work and ideas have been featured in many scientific journals, including the Journal of Molecular Biology, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, and Nature. He's also contributed ideas to Stephen Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell, as well as Simon Conway Morris's book, Life Solution. And Dr. Axe, it's good to have you with me. Thanks.
It's good to be here.
Now, let's go at this a little bit of autobiography here.
How did you first get interested in the big questions? In other words, not all scientists I've met over the years, including engineers, take on larger questions. And I'm just curious, how did you decide that you not only wanted to get the mechanics of things down, but you wanted to get the larger question of why and who and what down?
Yeah, that's as I think back about my childhood, I was raised in a non-church-going home, not an atheistic home, but not a church-going home. And then in my teen years, my first year in high school, I was 14, my whole family started attending a church in California in the Bay Area, and it was a conversion experience for all of us within a period of months. And so I was 14, starting my high school education and thinking about what I wanted to do for college. 4 years later, I found myself studying engineering, chemical engineering at UC Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And by then, I saw this sort of clash of worldviews between my newly inherited Christian worldview and this materialistic worldview. I don't think I would have given it that term at the time, but it was clear that the professors who were teaching and a lot of the students at Berkeley, and even going back to my high school education, public high school, had the view that everything happens just by physical causes. So somehow the universe came into existence, Big Bang or whatever, and after that it was all chemistry and physics. And I did not find that to be plausible, but I also saw the obvious tension between that view and what I believe to be true based upon Scripture, the Christian worldview. And I didn't want to just let that sit, and I didn't want to do the trick that some people do where they say, well, in my work life, I'll accept this view, and when I'm home, I'll work on this view. I knew there had to be one correct view, and I was not going to compartmentalize. I wanted to sort it out, so to speak.
So that pursuit of an answer, did that cost you professionally?
It did, and I tell the story in the book of ultimately losing my job in 2002 at the Medical Research Council Center in Cambridge. And I tell the story not out of sour grapes, not trying to get, restitution, but trying to get people to, I'm trying to dislodge this idea that I think still is prevalent in our culture that somehow science, because of its scientific method, it rises above all the human elements that taint every other human endeavor.
Right.
And I'm just trying to show people that if it's human beings doing science, then surprise, surprise, it's going to have all the baggage that comes with humanity as a part of science.
Yeah.
And it does.
There are prejudices, there are biases, there are mistakes, there's backbiting.
Right.
All this stuff is part of the world in which science occurs. Nobody perfectly embodies a scientific method as though it's infallible. So I hear stories like this regularly from people, and I've often thought it's difficult. A lot of people do what you said, though. A lot of people do just stop asking the questions professionally. They leave
right.
it to their home life or their church life or their meditation life or whatever they do. They don't deal with it professionally at all. How did that happen? Culturally, in the 19th century, especially in the Anglo world, a lot of the natural philosophy was being done by Anglican pastors, for heaven's sakes, the famous Bridgewater
right.
treatises. And Darwin, of course, is a titanic figure here. But what the heck
right.
was discovered that changed the attitudes of at least the Anglo-American scientific world, where we move from a generally theistic understanding of reality to a agnostic and eventually atheistic view of reality? What did Darwin find that nobody else had seen?
Well, I raised this in the book, and I argue that you actually have a historical record in the various editions of Darwin's book, On the Origin of Species, that shows pretty clearly that nothing was discovered.
Nothing new,
it was
right.
Nothing new. Yeah, I'm not saying that Darwin didn't say anything of relevance in his first 1859 edition of Origin of Species. But as you walk through those editions, there were six of them in total. In all of them, he has a couple of paragraphs that says, why is it that all of the living, all of the major naturalists of the day reject my theory? Okay, so he's a naturalist writing in 1859, and then in subsequent editions, going into the 60s and 1870s, everyone rejects his theory. And then in the sixth edition, he keeps those paragraphs, and he answers it, by the way, saying, I think it's just that everyone's blinded by their current view, and I look to the younger rising generation to take up this matter without prejudice and without bias, and I think they'll agree with me, basically, is what he said. Well, in the sixth edition of his book, he retains those paragraphs, and he says, interestingly, the situation now has almost completely changed. All the naturalists today, and this was like 1874, it wasn't that long after the first edition came out, all of them now agree with my theory, or at least with descent, the idea of descent with modification, that all living things are related through descent by modification. And there's no new data cited. It's not as though he said, oh, we had this great discovery in 1870, and that's what clinched it, and now everyone believes. So what clearly happened here is you have an entire discipline that does a 180 in terms of its view, and it's not data. It's not an argument that made it do the 180, because the argument had been out there. Darwin's argument had been out there for a decade or more.
Right.
It's a shift in culture, clearly, a shift in culture. And that tells you that that is how scientific – I'm not saying that data are never convincing and change everyone's mind. That does happen as well. But here's another way that scientific communities change their opinion. It is simply like a political – it's almost like a regime change. The power system changes and people realize, oh, I'm going to be in trouble if I don't go this way now. Whereas a year ago, I would have felt I'd be in trouble if I went the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's all changed, so I'm going to go this way.
Well, weren't there biologists at the time, 1859, when they read Origin of Species, and shortly thereafter, who believed that Darwin's perspective was compatible with a theistic understanding of life?
I'm sure there were. And yet the idea of separate creation of the different living species, I don't know if they were of the different categories of living things being separately created, was very well entrenched among naturalists of his day. So that's what he was arguing against, saying these things were not separately created. They're all descended from an earlier form. And here's how it happened. Natural selection was his explanation.
So let me try to understand. Let me try. Yeah, sure. Because this, you mentioned, you used the word classifications or categories, and these, that's part of the whole debate, isn't it? I mean, what are those categories? Are they species? Are they at a higher level? Or are they kinds, which is the biblical phrase that's often used? Were there well-defined categories? Like, you know, the taxonomy of Linnaeus, for instance. Was that orthodoxy at the time?
Well, he's the well-known sort of father of these classification systems.
Yeah.
And his ideas bleed through all the way to the present, ways of categorizing things.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's been upheaval since the molecular revolution, where it used to be morphological comparison. You look at the flower, the structure of the flower, you compare it to other flowers, and that's how you build these sort of groupings, or animals or whatever. When we first started getting DNA sequences, so in the later part of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
That kind of messed everything up, because everyone suddenly dropped the morphological comparison, the comparison of structure and form, and looked at DNA sequences instead and said, this is the real way we relate things. And it ended up wreaking havoc, because you got these claims that things were more closely related because of DNA sequence, that clearly, if you just look at them, you would say these can't be as closely related as you're saying. And to this day, this has not been sorted out. The molecular data do not give a consistent tree. Linnaeus didn't claim there was a tree. He simply grouped things in categories and subgroups within groups, so sort of a concentric ordering of things without claiming a tree. Darwin's contribution was the tree.
Okay, that's good. Let's hold it there. We'll take a break and come back, because I think that's a good place. Darwin gives us this tree where we've got common descent from a common ancestor, and that becomes his, that's an idea that becomes dominant. I'm Al Cresta.
FSI Label Company is a proud sponsor of Catholic Radio and a trusted label source for thousands of customers in numerous industries nationwide. FSI Label provides quality label solutions for any application that your business requires, and FSI is family-owned since 1971 and ISO 9001 certified for quality assurance. Turn to FSI Label for your next label requirement at FSILabel.com. Your quality product deserves a quality label. Go to FSILabel.com today.
The sore losing Liberal Democrats continue to whine about the outcome of the presidential election. They've tried desperately to alter its outcome, including failed efforts to recount the votes in swing states and conscripting washed up celebrities to try and influence the voters of the Electoral College. One of the more pernicious proposals is to do away with the Electoral College altogether, arguing that the president should be decided simply by the majority vote. This, however, would require a constitutional amendment, and amending our Constitution in this way will do nothing but harm it. To begin, we do not live in a pure democracy. Our form of government is a constitutional republic, and the genius of our founding fathers was to create a constitution that principally does two things. It protects liberty, and it prevents tyranny. Our founders created co-equal branches of government. They created a federal government with limited and enumerated powers. They set up a system of checks and balances. They adopted a Bill of Rights, and they established the Electoral College, among other things. If we change the Electoral College, the result would be that our president is chosen simply by the few population centers of the U.S., New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. But the people in these populated but insular cities don't speak for the people of places like Idaho, Indiana, or Texas. The Electoral College, in fact, ensures more diversity, something that the hypocritical liberal left is always screaming about. I'm Robert Hughes, co-founder and senior counsel with the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute. You can learn more about the American Freedom Law Center and its fight for your faith and freedom by visiting our website and liking us on Facebook.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten in part by Charity Mobile. Communication is critical. And in today's world, your cellular service is your lifeline to family and friends. Ave Maria Radio and Charity Mobile are partners in communicating the most important message of all, the good news of Jesus Christ. Charity Mobile is a provider of cellular LTE phones and service and has been a proud supporter of Ave Maria Radio and other pro-life causes for more than 10 years. More information at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Charity begins at phone.
Light of the East. Weekends on Ave Maria Radio.
I'm Father Thomas Loya. This week on Ave Maria, in Eastern Church's liturgy and asceticism have their own respective evangelical power, which must be continually rediscovered and unleashed as the way for the Eastern Churches to evangelize and make a difference.
Saturday evenings at 8:30 and Sunday mornings at 9 on 990 WDEO, Ave Maria Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
It isn't often that popes give parenting advice, but at a recent meeting of the Pontifical Council for the Family, Pope Francis did just that. And what was the tip? Waste time with your children. As moms and dads, we're like latter-day Marthas from the Bible, so busy with many things, we often forget to choose the better part of simply hanging out with our children and just being. Taking a walk, playing catch, gathering dolls for a tea party, wrestling on the floor, playing dress-up, just being silly are skills that teach parents and children the joy of living. As Pope Francis points out, the best way to learn that life is a gift, that relationships are important, and that it's people, not activities, that matter, is to simply be willing to waste time together. When we waste time with our children, we're not really wasting time at all. We're simply putting in the time that keeps our children's hearts from wasting. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
And a good afternoon to you. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Douglas Axe, author of Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. We're doing just a little bit of intellectual history there in the first segment. Darwin contributes this idea of descent from a common ancestor, this idea of the tree, the evolutionary tree. Is that his primary contribution then?
And I'm not claiming to be a historian of science. These are the parts that I've dealt with somewhat. I think there were people who claimed before Darwin that all of life was related, but it's attributed to Darwin. He was the one who certainly talked about it, the idea. It was rejected in his day, or at least when his book first came out, and then widely accepted by a decade and a half later.
Even though there's no new evidence, so there's peer pressure then.
Yeah, it's like a shift of. You can imagine you're just an ordinary biologist trying to do your job, make your living, and publishing and getting grant money is a part of how you make your living. If there's an idea of the day that's the dominant idea, you go with it or you fight against it. And if you fight against it, you better be prepared to, you know, take on a little bit of a struggle to fight against it.
Yeah.
So it's just human nature that you're gonna prepare yourself for doing battle against an entrenched, established idea, or you go with it. And most people go with it. The other, apart from the universal common ancestor, or this tree of all life, natural selection, of course, is the big idea that is associated with Charles Darwin, that the cause of the radiating branches of this tree is this phenomenon which he called natural selection, which he compared to artificial selection, the way that breeders of pigeons and chickens and dogs and cats get their various forms of these species by carefully selecting out attributes and breeding in order to accentuate those attributes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and that artificial selection is always based on intelligence, right?
Right, and it only goes so far.
Yeah.
You can get Chihuahuas and you can get Dalmatians and Great Danes from a diverse, original supply of dog diversity, but you don't get anything that's not a dog.
Right, right. And that remains true. I mean, this is why this whole thing has always puzzled me from the time I was in college. So I talk to people who are not known for having great interest in, quote, spiritual things. And most of them will say to me, you know, I look out there at this tree or I look at the stars and it just seems to me that it looks like things have a purpose, that there's some design behind things. Now, these are non-theologians who say stuff like this to me. It's kind of almost a common intuition, as you say they have. So then, why do we end up losing that?
I don't think we ever do. And indeed, I framed the book when I had an opportunity to write a book. I've done 25 years of research on this, looking at the molecular level, at genes. How do you get new proteins? How do you get the new information in genes to make new proteins? And when I had an opportunity to write about this, I wanted to tell a little bit about that work that I've done, but I wanted to hang the whole argument on something much more familiar. And so I used this intuition, this very intuition that you're referring to, which I call the universal design intuition.
Mm-hmm.
Early in the book, I quote Alison Gopnik at Berkeley, psychology professor. She was writing in the Wall Street Journal. She said, by elementary school age, children start to invoke an ultimate godlike designer to explain the complexity of the world around them.
Yeah.
Even children brought up as atheists.
Yeah.
So exactly as you were saying, it doesn't seem to matter what the family background
right.
is. Everyone gets this when they're 3 or 4 years old. Now, they suppress it. Many of them, or at least our education system, will suppress that and say, that's not correct. You have that intuition, but here's the real answer. I don't think anyone fully loses that intuition. I think we constantly, even a biologist who is a Darwinist, who professionally says, no, here's the correct answer, they always have to consciously suppress this idea that these things are designed.
Yeah, even Dawkins
that,
says...
This has been admitted.
Even Dawkins writes that things appear to be designed.
And Crick said biologists must constantly remind themselves that the things they're studying were not designed but rather evolved.
That's good.
If you have to constantly do that reminding, that's telling you that something else is working against what you're trying to tell yourself.
Well, tell us from your own experience then, why you have felt confirmed in that intuition that life is designed. In your own professional experience, what have you discovered that makes you say, I'm stronger in this today than I was even 20 years ago?
Well, so I set out, I was doing a PhD at Caltech as an engineer, but realizing I was really interested in the life sciences, so I pushed my thesis project toward biology as well, and I had a biologist on my examining committee when I did my thesis defense. About midway into my PhD, or maybe a little earlier, I realized, you know, someone should do the work that tests whether these marvelous things that fill living things at the molecular level, whether these things can come about the way Darwin said they can or not.
Mm-hmm.
Can these things be accidental, these things that look like marvelous inventions? Can they be accidental, or must they be designed things that were made intentionally and ingeniously? And so I started thinking about what sort of experiments I would do to test this, and I zeroed in on proteins, which are these chain-like molecules that get made according to the sequence instructions in genes. And the reason I thought of that is, yes, you can talk about dogs and birds and plants and life forms of the various kinds and say, how would you get a primate? But you really can't go into the lab and say, okay, here's how you get a primate, or test how you would get a primate. Whereas if you look at a single gene, we were starting to develop at the time very sophisticated methods for going into the lab and modifying single genes and mm-hmm. seeing what the modifications do. So I thought, here's some place. Here's a level that's narrow enough and small enough and tractable enough that I could go into a lab and figure out how these things work or how hard it is to get them to work. And so I started doing that, and 25 years later, I was pretty confident. Based on my work and colleagues' work who were joining me in this, we had nailed this and looked at the various aspects of this problem, and we had shown that these things, functional gene sequences, are so rare within the space of possibilities that there's no way an accidental process could stumble upon them.
Mm-hmm.
And that really undercuts the whole Darwinian story.
Yeah.
And this is published work, peer-reviewed published work. And we kept going with it and looked at various levels of these proteins. Can you shift the function of a protein from function A to function B? And even in tests where it looks very favorable in terms of the potential to do that, we find that the number of mutations, the number of changes to the DNA required to do that is beyond what you could get by accidental evolution.
Huh.
Now, but in the book, I give a snapshot of those experiments, but I realize in the book I want to argue a different way, and that is to use something that I call common science.
Mm-hmm.
It's common sense applied to everyday observation and reasoning. I argue that we all do something that's very much like science. We're all scientists at a very simple level.
Mm-hmm.
And you can show that our design intuition is correct using that sort of argument. So that's really what I base the book on, is I walk the reader, who I assume is not a scientist, through a simple common sense way of knowing that, yes, that intuition that you had when you were four about life turns out to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, you could go into a lab the way I did and test it, and you also confirm that it's correct.
You know, why don't you just continue on with that then? You've done it scientifically. You've made the case. So how then do you, how would people who don't have access to labs and the formation of hypotheses and all the work, the mathematical work that you've done, how do they go about demonstrating this?
That was what I was scratching my head when I had an opportunity to write the book and thinking, well, what I could do is say, here's how I looked at single genes and single proteins. Here are the experiments we did. In simple language, this is what it means, and this is why it makes evolution impossible. But I knew that if I wrote the book that way, a non-scientific reader would say, okay, I see Axe thinks this is a compelling argument. Let me look online and see if there are any biologists who think he got it wrong. And, of course, they would find lots of biologists.
There's always going to be something.
Arguing.
Right.
Yes, there's always someone who says, no, he lied to you. they didn't do that right, he didn't look at this protein. And then I felt sorry for the reader who would not have any idea how you sort out this mess that you get when you have, you know, people clashing in that way. And so I really felt like the way forward is to say, look, you're going to get that mess if you go online. But let me show you how you, by your own experience, what you can confirm in your own mind based on your own experience, how you can know that these things do not happen by accident. And if I can succeed in that, then you can go online and no one is going to convince you otherwise. You know that life cannot be accidental, and here's how you know it. So that's really the approach I took. Looking at everyday things like written language, mm-hmm. I use an illustration using written language. I use one using digital photographs, pixels making up photographs. What do you need to have in order for these colors, red, green, and blue, to form an image that you recognize as a recognizable image? What do you need to have in order for the letters of the alphabet to provide instructions? And if you start to tease that apart, you can show that what you need to have is something that I call functional coherence. You need to have these small things arranged intelligently to produce a succession of higher and higher level things. You have to get your letters arranged to make words, and you have to arrange those words to make phrases, phrases to make sentences, sentences to make paragraphs, and so on. And if you look at the just very simple calculation, if you look at the probability of those arrangements happening by accident, it turns out to be so fantastically improbable that there's no way it could happen. Not in billions of years, not in, you know, billions of planets across the history of the universe. It can't happen.
And so the one who maintains that it can happen then is exercising considerable faith, right, in chance.
It's bad faith.
Yeah, that, I'm saying yes. It flies in the face of all we do know.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. See, that I agree, and I'm just surprised. We've got a real battle on our hands here because our culture is in the grip of a real irrational approach to life. I'd like to talk with you at greater length, Douglas, in the future, because I think you've done a wonderful job in the book, and it deserves more time than we're able to give it today. So I hope we can get together again.
I'd love to do that.
Very good. Dr. Douglas Axe. It's called Undeniable. We're going to return to the story in the future, how biology confirms our intuition that life is designed.
Sacred Heart Major Seminary's Professor Mira Healy goes digging for gold on Putting on the Mind of Christ this week.
Because if you haven't experienced that, God wants to give it to you. You can go to the Mother of Jesus and say, I don't have the wine. Do something. And go to Jesus and say, I want that wine that you give. When we read those Advent scriptures, we're supposed to hear those and say, yes, I know what that's talking about. I have experienced that. God wants that for you. All you have to do is ask and keep asking and keep asking, and He will answer that prayer.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting on the Mind of Christ. Our search in the Ave Maria archives this week found a treasure talk by Dr. Mary Healy. It's Digging for Gold in the Gospel of John. Listen to Putting on the Mind of Christ this Sunday afternoon at 3, encoring Saturday afternoons at 6 on 990 WDEO, 1440 WMAX, and AveMariaRadio.net on the Internet.
Did you know that Ave Maria Town in Southwest Florida is really growing?
Tell me about it.
Ave Maria truly is one of the nation's fastest growing master planned new home communities.
Is that because there's no snow?
Well, the weather sure helps, but Ave Maria, Florida is a unique place.
How so?
The town of Ave Maria has been designed as a hometown for the 21st century, a place where residents of different generations and backgrounds can find all they need to live life to the fullest. School, shopping, employment opportunities, and more. In addition, the presence of Ave Maria University, a Catholic university that is both excellent and affordable.
Sounds great. What else?
Houses are being sold starting in the low 200s with several communities to choose from. There's a private Catholic K-12 school along with golf, bike trails, a fitness center, not to mention several daily masses and adoration within walking distance.
So how can I arrange a visit?
Call Carol at 239-249-2111. That's Carol Carpenter at Berkshire Hathaway, 239-249-2111.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Do follow up on our conversation today by going to AveMariaRadio.net And you can find further information about both Ed Lancer and Lachelle Van Outen, and also the work of Douglas Axe. We'll have go to the AveMariaRadio.net page. You'll see the Cresta tab. Hit that. Our daily tab comes up. It has access to all of our podcasts, that previous shows, our archives. It has today's information, ways of contacting Douglas Axe and Lachelle. So it's a pretty handy. If you want to go further than we can in the daily program, it's always good to go there to the Cresta Guest Archive. Now, coming up, as soon as I go off the air, we've got an open forum with Jimmy Akin and Father John Trujillo on Catholic Answers Live. Tonight on EWTN Television, it's the World Over Live with Raymond Arroyo. Now, tomorrow on Cresta in the Afternoon, we're going to have canon lawyer Ed Peters on with us to take some of your questions on this recent concern that people have about the pastoral letter of the Maltese bishops. I mentioned this yesterday, and I think it's very important for us to discuss these matters with the absolute clarity of what the Church teaches. So we know full well what the Church teaches about marriage, civil divorce, remarriage, and the Eucharist. And we'll, of course, recite it again tomorrow. But there is no doubt about the Church's teaching here. There is some doubt on how to apply it. There's some confusion about how to properly apply that teaching. And we're going to talk it over with Ed because canon law plays an important role in all of this. So I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for being with me today.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. The executive producer is Nick Tom. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506. Or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506. Or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.
Would you like a copy of this program? If you miss a part of this program or want to hear it again, Ave Maria programming can be made yours when you order. Just call 734-930-4506. Within a few weeks, you'll receive a copy of this show and any others you want to order on CD. Call 734-930-4506.
If you had stage 4 cancer, would you march for life in sub-freezing weather in Washington, D.C.? Hi, I'm Peggy Stanton. Join me on Power from the Pews to hear the dramatic witness of a woman willing to give her life for life. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio and AveMariaRadio.net.
Hi, Deacon Tom here with a reminder that Ave Maria Radio has some terrific gift ideas for you. Books by our hosts and our guests, recordings on CD, and our new Wi-Fi radios, so you can listen to Catholic radio anywhere in the world, anytime you want, as long as you have a Wi-Fi connection. Just go to our website and click the word store on the right side of the page, just below the EWTN logo. It's an easy way to shop, and you can help Catholic radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
Food for the Journey's Sister Ann Shields on the struggles of compromising that leads to a failure of growing with the Lord.
Brothers and sisters, you really can make decisions that bring clarity. Don't just live with the status quo. Don't just say, well, this is the kind of person I am. These are my strengths.